Will he woo her? Aye, or I'll hang her. Why came I hither but to that intent? And now we get the male ego boasting, saying, I can take care of her. I can. Think you a little din can daunt mine ears? Have I not in my time heard lions roar? Have I not heard the sea puffed up with winds, rage like an angry boar, chafed with sweat? This is all pompous posturing. He's probably done some of this. But the point is, I'm a real man. I went deep sea fishing off Cuba. I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I went on a safari and killed a tiger. I can handle it. This is, again, this is the male ego. And the proper response should be, oh, just shut up. You know, if you really did and it was all that great, you don't have to tell us about it. And the point being, I can do anything. I can do anything. Now, in the film, this is, again, one of those magnificent touches that Zeffirelli puts in. Burton launches into this speech. Burton is just magnificent. Pompous, vulgar, loud. He's just mad. And as he's giving this speech, we hear furniture breaking within the house. Smash! He's using the speech, and it's brilliantly done. This is what a good director can do. He's using the speech to pump himself up because he's about to take on a real challenge in there. And then just as he ends the speech with, and do you tell me of a woman's tongue that gives not half so great a blow to hear as will a chestnut in a farmer's fire? Tush, tush, fear boys with bugs. And he starts to move forward, and the shutters explode out of the house, and they all go reeling backward. Point being, you may have done all those things. You're about to encounter a woman whose will is out of control. Better you should confront a storm, a raging boar. You're much safer with those things. Because what we have here, and Shakespeare knew it, is not a force of nature alone, but a force of nature combined with a spiritual intent. This is a woman's will. And he has never encountered anything like this. He never has. It's a simple fact. Please notice what we get in Acts 2, 3, and 4. Act 2 is the wooing, a totally unconventional wooing scene. Again, Zeffirelli gives us the gist of it. It's a wrestling match. It's a contest between two pros, okay? But what we are seeing is something quite extraordinary. And once again, Petruchio has made a claim that is basically wrong-headed. He has made the claim to Baptista. I'm looking for the speech right now. I'm in Act 2, Scene 1, right before the wooing begins. Baptista is terrified. He's been living with this woman for years. And says, well, it's the deal is set, and he gives him a huge, after my death, half of my lands, 20,000 crowns. And for that dowry, I'll assure her of her widowhood, be it that she survived me, and all my lands and leases whatsoever. This is a bargain. This is a financial bargain. Then Baptista says, aye, when the special thing is well obtained, that is her love, for that is all in all. It's a toss away. It's a footnote. It's a footnote. And Petruchio says, why, that is nothing. her love, but that is nothing. For I tell you, Father, I am as peremptory as she proud-minded. And where two raging fires meet together, they do consume the thing that feeds their fury. The image is, I can be just as tough as she can. We come together and we'll burn each other out. That'll be it. That's not what happens. The simple fact of the matter is, when a real man meets a real woman, and even if they engage in the sort of less than high-minded courtship that goes on in the wooing of Act 2, the man becomes more masculine and the woman begins to show herself as feminine. There are only touches. If we had the film here, I could sort of run through it again. There are only touches, but there are moments when Petruchio now has to be clever. He's not hunting big game at this moment. He is engaged with a woman who is trying to escape him, wants nothing to do with him. And as they battle, as that scene goes back and forth, each realizes the other is a worthy opponent. Katerina, after years of being surrounded by these pipsqueaks and elderly folk and fops, has suddenly met a real man. And Petruchio, who thought he'd marry anything just so long as he got the money, is assured of the money. Well, I'll tell you, if any actress has ever looked more beautiful than Liz in that film, I don't know. That moment when the shutter goes open and you just see her eye looking out and it's pure violet. I mean, the woman has violet eyes. I mean, that alone, whoa, you know. There are moments in that film when she is absolutely dazzling. This is no bore. This is no storm. This is no mountain. This is something magnificent, and he confronts it. And, yeah, it will challenge him. And that chase around the house, which can be done on film, can't be done on stage, is just stupendous. Just stupendous. Please notice again the little touches. When she thinks she's escaped him, rolling in that wool, biting the apple. It's magnificent. Zeffirelli knew exactly what he was doing. Okay, we've got the woman who thinks she's in control chewing on that apple. Okay, at the same time we've got the wonderful moment when she's sitting on the trapdoor and has brought the big bales of grain on top of it and is sitting there thinking she's safe. And with all of his strength, he pushes the thing upward. It's suddenly you have Atlas, who's taking on the weight of the world in order to beat this woman. It's Meg. It is not your conventional wooing. But these are not your conventional people, and even out of the struggle, they are beginning to define each other. Now, she does not give in. The wedding is not a conventional wedding. It's only spoken of in the text. Zeffirelli films it. It's uproariously funny. It's not a proper wedding. But of course, what Petruchio is doing is treating her the way she's treated everyone else. He is wild, unpredictable, antisocial. He is doing all those things. He is behaving as she has behaved. She is, if you will, getting her own back. And suddenly on the wedding day, which is hugely important to all women, even one being married against her will, suddenly she's being made a travesty. Absolute travesty, which is why after the wedding, she again reasserts that will. And we get a battle of the male, in this case, the male authority subduing the female will. I do this speech. They go to the wedding banquet. And Petruchio says, it's just wonderful. I'm sorry we can't stay. We have to go. She said, what are you talking about then? Groom me on my horse. Aye, sir, they be ready. The oats have eaten the horses. I love it. Please notice again that every detail, magnificent. The comic inversion. The horses haven't eaten the oats. The oats have eaten the horses. Everything's upside down here. Nay then, do what thou canst, Katerina says. I will not go today, no, nor tomorrow, not till I please myself. The door is open, sir. There lies your way. You may be jogging while your boots are green. For me, I'll not be gone till I please myself. This is publicly. This is at the wedding feast. The wedding feast is not a typical wedding feast, because the groom has said, we're leaving. Oh, Kate, content thee, prithee, be not angry. I will be angry. I love it. What hast thou to do? Father, be quiet. Baptiste hasn't said anything. He's obviously opened his mouth to talk, and his daughter says, Father, be quiet, at the wedding feast in front of everyone. He shall stay my leisure. Don't say anything to me, Father. He'll do what I want to do. Gentlemen, forward to the bridal dinner. I see a woman may be made a fool if she had not a spirit to resist. Petruchio. Please notice this. This is brilliant. I'm in Act 3, Scene 2, line 220. They shall go forward, Kate, at thy command. The bride is given an order. She is given an order at her bridal feast to all the celebrants, and they must follow it. That is a proper command. Okay? That is a proper command. Obey the bride, you that attend on her. Go to the feast, revel and domineer, carouse full measure to her maidenhead. Be mad and merry, or go hang yourselves. But for my Bonnie Kate, she must with me. Look not big, nor stamp, nor stare, nor fret. And now as she had shut her father up, he's shutting her up. I will be master of what is mine own. And we get another one of those desperately male egotistical speeches. She is my goods, my chattel. She is my house, my household stuff, my field, my barn, my horse, my axe, my ox, my ass, my anything. And here she stands. Touch her, whoever dare. I'll bring mine action on the proudest he that stops my way in Padua. And he fights his way out. Please notice, he begins by insulting her. You're going to behave this way? You don't want to be my wife? Fine, then you are a thing. But you're my thing, and I'll defend you. and I'll defend you and fight our way out of here in case anyone tries to stop us to make us stay at our own wedding feast. Please notice a world turned upside down. A world gone topsy-turvy. But of necessity, because these people still have not yet clearly defined themselves, but notice what's happening. We have the husband defending his wife. We now have the husband claiming, this woman is my woman now. She is mine. Now, admittedly, he's ranking her with the house and his ass and his ox, which is hardly fair. But he's saying, she is mine now. We are one. Now, Act 4, we go to Petruchio's. And again, now we get the marriage feast, which he won't let her touch. He will not let her eat. Okay? And nothing in the house is good enough for her now. Okay? You want to be willful? Then I'll see to it you have only the best. Not this food, not this bed, not this clothing. And he goes on a rampage of destruction, doing what she was doing to her father's house. I'll make you feel like you're at home. I'll destroy everything here. Only I won't let you do it. I'll do it because it's my house and I'm in charge. But I'll behave as you would behave if you could be in charge. Let's destroy things. Now, what is an open possibility in the text, that is when we arrive at the house, there is a lot of talk about whether it's in order or not, but we don't really know. The servants say, yes, everything's in order, is turned into a moment of comic genius by Zeffirelli in the film. Katerina gets her revenge by cleaning. And in the film, we get one of the first moments where we see the real woman in her exploding outward and her beginning to understand how you revenge yourself on a man who's living like a pig in a sty. What do? You clean the place. You dust, you wash, you put people in proper costumes. That scene of her cleaning is the scene of her taking control, but it is also a wonderful indication of her becoming a woman, because what the woman does, and it is absolutely basic, is she is taking over her domain. She is making the nest. She is making the nest. And it is a way of saying, all right, this is my space now, and if it's my space, then it will be agreeable to me. And there's that marvelous sense of her finally beginning. It happens earlier in the Zeffirelli film than it does in the play. But I think it's a lovely touch. It's a lovely touch. And again, something that he does brilliant visually as we watch it happen. Now, we return then. The word comes of the marriage of Lucentio and Bianca. I'm not going through much of it. Again, please notice, we have the pedant who pretends to be Lucentio's father. He's not really the father, the real father. It's constant. And finally, Katerina is made so miserable by Petruchio's kindness, his excessive attention to her. Oh, there's a wonder, one of the servants says, he kills her in her own humor. He's behaving just as she would behave, and it's killing her. And then he kills her with kindness. No, this dress isn't good enough for you. This cap isn't good enough for you to wear. Whack! And he hacks the thing in half. Okay, and then he says, look, we'll go back to the wedding feast, but we'll wear whatever. And then comes an extraordinary moment where Petruchio begins to become the male. And there is a very real change in who he is. I'm in Act 4, Scene 3, at line about 165. "Well, come, my Kate, we will unto your fathers, even in these honest, mean habiliments. We'll go, but we're not going to dress up. Nothing fancy." Right at the outset, it's clear he is teaching her a lesson. But in order to teach her a lesson, he has to walk into the wedding feast not looking his best. The male ego, in one sense, is about to subdue itself. The sword will not be quite as bright as it might otherwise be. And then, as the speech goes on, he says, "Oh, no, good Kate, neither art thou the worse for this poor furniture and mean array. If thou accountest it shame, lay it on me, and therefore frolic. If you're embarrassed, if you're ashamed of this, blame me. Say it's my fault." And we have the man willing to take the burden of his own actions and allowing his wife to say, it's that SOB I married. He's a jerk. He made me come here wearing this. He's just terrible. And Petruchio says, you may do that. Don't embarrass yourself. Do not take any of this on yourself. Put it on me. Now, in that very phrase, we begin to get the sense of what's happening here. Petruchio is saying to his wife, I will take the burden of this. Any shame, whatever happens to you, I will take it. And now I'm going to turn to, in order to look at the last part of the play, one of those moments that just, it's how we know Shakespeare was deep in his own way into the scriptures and knew them. I'm quoting, in fact, my copy of this comes from a votive mass for a bridegroom and bride. The epistle from Ephesians 5. "Brethren, wives must obey their husbands as they would obey the Lord. The man is the head to which the woman's body is united, just as Christ is the head of the church. He, the Savior, on whom the safety of his body depends, and women must owe obedience at all points to their husbands, as the church does to Christ. You who are husbands must show love to your wives as Christ showed love to the church when he gave himself up on its behalf. He would hallow it, purify it by bathing it in the water to which his word gave life. He would summon it into his own presence." I'm stopping right there. The passage goes on, but please notice the final test in the play is the summoning of the wife into the presence of the husband. The ladies have retired to the other room, and Petruchio establishes a bet as to whose wife. Hortensio has married the widow. Lucentio has married Bianca. And the question is, which wife will be obedient and come when summoned? And the final dramatic action comes right out of that gospel. Obeying the command. Coming when summoned. They talk about what's the wager. Let's each one send unto his wife, and he whose wife is most obedient to come at first when he doth send for her shall win the wager which we will propose. Says Petruchio. It is trust. Please notice, it is public. It is public. "Content, what's the wager?" Lucentio says, 20 crowns. Petruchio, 20 crowns? I'll venture so much of my hawk or hound, but 20 times so much upon my wife. Now think back to the man we met at the beginning of the play. Principal concern, money. Money connected with what? Ego and pride. What's he doing? Laying it all on the line out of trust in his wife. This is an extraordinary moment. And all he really has to suspect she will obey is that wonderful little scene where he calls the sun the moon and she goes along, and he calls the old Vicentio the young blushing virgin, and she goes and kisses. It's a wildly funny scene. It's very funny. And the moment as they go into the wedding feast where he asks her for a kiss, and she is embarrassed, says not to kiss, but in public. But what he wants is a public display, and she does it. Again, Zeffirelli, brilliant. She gives him a little peck on the forehead, which means we're not quite sure if she's there yet or not, which makes this wager all the more important. Petruchio isn't absolutely sure he's going to win. He could not only be humiliated, he could lose 20,000 crowns. Okay, huge amount of money. But he's making the wager. Content, a match, 'tis done. It's wonderful. Of course, Lucentio summons Bianca first. She refuses to come. Hortensio then summons the widow. The widow says, tell him to come to me. which is riotously funny. But again, a mark of the total disorder, because it's clear she is wearing the pants in the family. Okay? He's effeminate. She's wearing the pants. You tell him to come to me. Okay? Petruchio then summons Caterina. She shows up. These are lines cut. This is wonderful. He then sends her back to get the other women. And Lucentio says, here is a wonder, if you talk of a wonder. These guys can't believe what's happened. Hortensio says, and so it is. I wonder what it bodes. And Petruchio says, Mary, peace it bodes, and love, and quiet life, and awful rule, and right supremacy. And to be short, what not that's sweet and happy. What does it bode? All good things for me. It's absolutely magnificent. It's a shame. The line's cut from the film, but it's magnificent. In she comes carrying the others, dragging the others. I love it in the film. Liz is good at that moment. Dragging the other two women in. Boom, down on the ground they go. And she gives the great speech. What I'm going to do tomorrow night, I don't have time to go through the speech in detail. Tomorrow night I'm going to do a close analysis of that speech. One of the great speeches Shakespeare ever wrote. A couple of you today have spoken to me about poetry. I'll also take some time tomorrow and analyze some of it poetically. Give you a little sense of how you look at poetry and why, if it were written in prose, it wouldn't be the same speech. Okay? How poetry is working. That's what I'll do tomorrow night. But there is one more thing. She finishes the great speech, which is about the obedience that a wife owes to a husband. At which point, now this is something that sticks in the craw of all modern critics, all modern theater people. They simply cannot abide that speech or what happens at the end of the play. I will simply quote the very liberal and crazy Mr. George Bernard Shaw, who said, the last scene is altogether disgusting to modern sensibility. And yes, it is, because modern sensibility is not Catholic and anti-God's order. The play was scheduled to be done at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. two seasons ago. The director dropped out finally. He's a good director. He actually does a decent job, but he said he could not comprehend the ending of this play. He couldn't direct it. He could not wrap his mind around the ending of the play. It was so foreign to him. It shows what's happened to us. There are those who try to twist it out of context and claim she's only pretending to do this. Nonsense. But one can make a rather more direct point. Having now fulfilled her proper role and become an obedient wife, having, if you will, validated her husband in public, not to mention won him a bucket of money, what will he ever deny her? And at that moment, the complexity of what St. Paul says in the letter to the Ephesians comes clear. Women must obey their husbands. In doing so, they subjugate that will that can destroy them, but which also defines them, to a higher authority. The woman subjugates her own will. But then St. Paul says, husbands, love your wives. And at that moment, the male ego must acknowledge there is an other in the world and set his focus on that other and love that other more than he loves himself. So that in doing what St. Paul commands in Ephesians, we have a perfect coupling in which the female will is there and strong. And what does the female will? The female wills to do what her husband tells her to do. We have the male ego that focuses, that wants the fullness of self. How does it attain fullness of self? By recognizing that the wife by his side is his self, his very self. And he must love that self fully. It is a perfect connection. And at that moment, I love the response. Petruchio says, "Why, there's a wench. Come on and kiss me, Kate." And for the first time in the play, we have a kiss of full affection. Full affection. He fully loves his wife as a husband should love his wife. And she obeys in kissing him. And at that moment, the marriage is complete. The marriage is complete. And that wonderful explosion of joy that comes at the end of it is what should come at the end of a comedy, because out of the disorder with which the play has begun comes perfect order. What is that perfect order? It is the order as God intended it to be created. I'll stop there. I've got time for a couple of questions. I'll go into the long speech in depth tomorrow night. It's a great speech. It's a great speech. But I don't have time to do it now. Any questions about anything? There is the sense of all the way through. Chastity is a high virtue, without any doubt. No question about it. And the fruits that come from that are special in their way. It seems to me that we simply have presented there two options, but I don't think they dominate the play. They don't become as central as they might. It is simply a vision of two options. The curious thing is at the end of the play, that sentimental relationship, that sentimental romantic relationship between Lucentio and Bianca has come to very little. We have the sense that there is a troubled marriage ahead there, because it is simply based on the wrong principles. Hortensio and the widow gets into a whole series of problems. The woman whose will is unchecked will end up becoming a man, attempting to become a man. She never will. It can never happen. The man whose ego then is dominated by that will cease being masculine. And you have this horrible the relationship between Hortensio and the widow is a total perversion, but in a curious way the closest vision to what we have now. And it's not necessary. It's a barren relationship. Curiously, we can take that. If any of you know the Edward Albee play, and it's interesting because Burton and Taylor filmed that at the same time they were filming this, where you have the barren marriage and the woman who is masculine and the spineless, weak husband, and it's just a horrendous battle. That kind of relationship always creates barrenness, which in many cases is something very different from chastity. It's a puzzle. It's a puzzle. Yes.
The theory that is normally given that she's just putting this on, and it's not really, that's something that I've heard unanimously. Like my high school and
yep.
college English
yep.
teachers and my high school drama
yep.
teacher. Is that something that a professor of English now teaches?
Yes, that's all. The play is rarely taught. It's such an embarrassment it's rarely taught. When it is taught, that's the lie that's told about it. Anyone who can read that last speech and think it's a put-on has a tin ear and no understanding of language. But part of the problem is they still understand the greatness of the play, but they cannot understand the idea that is behind it. And therefore they have to turn it into a lie. If she is simply putting on in order to deceive him and get her own way, we don't have a comedy. We have a very sour, ugly ending. And that's what they're suggesting. And they think that's a good thing because it no longer offends modern sensibilities. Modern sensibilities need to be more than offended. They need to be horsewhipped. It's just... But again, what happens... That's the reason why. Let me say this. You cannot find good comedy being created now. It's not possible to create a real comedy anymore. It can't be done. It can't be done. We do not understand what it's about. As a result, it's you get these strange concoctions with unhappy endings and twisted characters who can never straighten themselves out in any way. It's horrible. I love it. I love it. We know what she's up to, and we know it by the looking at the children, and now we've had the wedding banquet. Now we're going to have the wedding night, and at that moment she's being flirtatious, which a wife can be with a husband, and soon there will be little Petruchios and little Kates. I just read something wonderful. I've just been rereading all of C.S. Lewis. I came upon a wonderful comment by Lewis talking about the difference between romantic love, eros, if you will, and something more complex, which has to do with Christian love, that is the love of marriage. And he makes the following comment. Those of you that know opera, Wagner and Mozart in particular will enjoy this. He said, what the world is standing in need of now is less Tristan and Isolde, heaving passion, grand romance, and more Papageno and Papagena. The sheer joy of a couple coming together and looking forward to just making as many children as they can possibly have, with Mozart's music just chattering in the background. The just light-hearted glee at the prospect of a huge family, you know, as opposed to the rather darker... No, they're off to begin a family. Yes. Which is as it should be, and again, which is the end and purpose. It's I think it's quite nicely done. Yeah. She is being flirtatious. Yes. He's not carrying her off over his shoulder. He's not being the hunter at that moment. Yeah.
Is it only a husband
giving him a shrimp? There's only one other possibility, and that's a good priest. And I don't say that just as a kind of joke. One of my other favorite works, it's a modern film that deals with the same subject. There's a wonderful moment where a difficult woman has been married and is causing terrible difficulties in the marriage. And she at least is aware that things aren't going right in their problems. It's John Ford's The Quiet Man. And Maureen O'Hara goes to the parish priest and tells him that, you know, she's denying the marriage bed to her husband because they're not getting along and they're fighting. And the priest just reads her the riot act. And she's standing there with tears running down her face. Of course, he's fishing at that moment. Again, it's a great comic work. And, you know, and in Ireland, we may be a poor country, but in this country, a husband sleeps in his own bed. And she's just crying, oh, yes, Father, yes. And it's a wonderful moment of suddenly she is listening to the priest. Because there is that sense of... She was raised to obey the priest, and when he tells her something, of course, at that moment he catches a fish, and the two of them are then trying to get the fish. It's beautifully done. Because what happens at that same moment is nature intervenes in another way, and we have man battling nature in order to get the fish in. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. A good priest, but again, you need an obedient woman, someone who is willing to listen. I think only to. It's the importance of fathers early on. Fathers have to raise children to be obedient. And if there isn't that going on in the home early on, then there's going to be trouble later, all the way down the line. And again, that's why this play begins with the weak father who's let his house run out of control. And the absent father, Vicentio, who sends his son off to study and just trusts him. Kid's too young. You can't trust. You know. Yeah, and we get disorder. Yes. Oh, yeah. And I think the film captures that beautifully at moments. When she suddenly realizes she's being looked at and, you know, puts on a little smile. And you get the sides of Bianca. Bianca's playing a role as well. There is some of her sister in her. We only see it in moments. But we see it most fully at the end when she refuses to come, to obey when her husband calls her. We have the sense that's something that she has not revealed until this moment. She got him, she won him, now she'll do what she wants. Now her will is asserting itself. We don't have the sweet, demure little girl anymore. We're seeing the woman who was there all along, who at the end of the play asserts her will. And it's going to be trouble. It's going to be trouble. But at that moment, it's clear the two sisters are sisters. It's just one made it big, open, and evident, and it's now overcome it. And the other pretended to be demure, and now at the end is doing what she will have her will. She will have. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And at that moment, it's Katerina trying to get Bianca to say who is her love. Who does she really love? And Bianca won't say anything. And of course, there's nobody really there to love. But the notion is Katerina knows that she can't trust her sister to tell the truth without breaking a chair at her or whipping her. That's only, Katerina knows that's the only way you get the truth out of this young girl. So Katerina's on to her early on, whereas the father's fawning all over her and the men are fawning all over her. Too much fawning is not good for any child, much less one as beautiful as that actress who plays Bianca. Whoa, she's just lovely. Just lovely. Yes, yes. Good casting on Zeffirelli's part all around. Yeah. But sadly, apparently Burton and Taylor were living that out. It wasn't. although they never came to fully understand the ending, which is sad. Just sad. Any other questions? I've got a minute. I'll do this quickly. Oh, there is one. Go ahead. It was very successful. It was hugely popular. Hugely popular. But again, even at that point, Protestant England still had its house in order. I mean, it's been... What can we say? It's been a process of decay. But at that point, they wouldn't have trouble with what the play was saying. They would not have trouble with what the play was saying. It was very, very popular. Very. It was not until our own time it's become a very unpopular play. And yet when the Zeffirelli film came out in 66, it was a huge hit. Did very well at the box office. Nobody had trouble with it then. 30 years later, it's contraband. You have to smuggle it around. My colleagues see me carrying it down the hallway and they wince and give me ugly looks. You know, how dare he show that? How dare he teach that play? And of course, I am forbidden. I am forbidden by the Academy to talk about any differences between men and women. That's the rule from on high. Okay, we're not to. It's all the same. But that's the reason I teach this play. So, of course, when they call me and say, what have you been saying? Oh, it's not what I'm saying. It's what Shakespeare's saying. You know, it's like the moment in one of the Marx Brothers films where I think it's Chico is beating up on this other guy. And he says, stop it. Why are you doing this? And he says, well, I'm not doing it. It's what he's doing to me. I'm just showing you what he's doing. Well, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I'm just showing you what he's doing. So that I'm not saying anything. I'm just teaching what Shakespeare wrote. You pay me to teach Shakespeare. What am I supposed to do? Oh, it's fiery. It's exciting. I am told that they leave when I do Shrew almost always. They leave the classroom and go back to the hall and discuss it behind closed doors. They can't talk about it openly, but there'll be gatherings in rooms where they'll read passages aloud. But again, I would say the problem, I mean, most of the women find it very offensive, but they should. They're marching around in pants. They're running the place. Those who are in charge are all Baptistas. The men who are running the place are not doing their job and have allowed disorder. So you have these tough, willful females who are running the military now, because the men are all cowards, as Baptista is. There is complete disorder. It's a perfectly appropriate play to teach. And so I teach it regularly. I start the Shakespeare course with it. We do some sonnets and then boom, into this. And my point being, you know, he is not one of us. He is saying something very different from what you're hearing out in the world. And if you don't believe me, we'll read Taming of the Shrew. Yeah. So they're modernists. They are offended, the women. The guys love it. But most of the guys have spent their time being like Petruchio in the first act. That's their response. And they get uncomfortable when I talk about what it means to become a civilized man and to really love a woman. It's something they don't know about. Their vision is, if you're going to be a man, then you're a pig. You drive a fast car and you do what on Saturday night, and you get lots of money. And they're all Petruchio in Act One. So it's as tough on them, finally. But I make them go through it. And you can't help. It's my point with Shakespeare. You cannot help but read Shakespeare and not understand that this man is a truth teller. Even a play like this that seems to be going against the modern grain, if you look at a good production of it, it touches something deep inside. Why? Because he touches truths. Why is he still done 400 years later? Because he is telling truths, even if they're uncomfortable ones we don't like. And then, of course, you get the same thing when I teach Macbeth. Macbeth is the dark side of this. Macbeth is the female will that is twisted, and the man's ambition that runs out of control. I understand what you're saying, but again, it seems to me that usually if something like that is going on, there's a problem with the husband as well. Okay? And even if one is talking about a relationship before marriage, it is a matter of dealing with a couple. The title is Taming of the Shrew, but I would say much of the focus here is on Petruchio. And I would also say that the men in this play come off much worse than the women. It is a world of men not doing their jobs. It seems to me, particularly for anyone going into the priesthood, I think the priest in a properly constructed society could put order in a disruptive woman's life, but he would need to do it with the man who obviously has problems himself, or there wouldn't be problems in the relationship. Pardon? Probably. Yeah, and blame the husband for everything, I would guess. But you see, that's the problem. No, that's the problem. Can you imagine Petruchio taking the blame for anything? He never does. He changes. He will take certain burdens, you know. He'll take certain burdens, but he doesn't, you know. And there's just one moment when he does that, and that's in private. I think it's much tougher to make the men manly now. Much more difficult to make the men manly.